Hello, everyone, and welcome to True Crime Talkers San Diego, episode number 18. As always, I'm your host, Jamie. I have a little bit of announcement to make for this episode. I'm currently recording in a motel in New Mexico. Yes, you heard that right. My mom and I had to last-minute drive across country to Georgia for a family funeral, so if you hear any weird background noises, that's why. Now, this week's episode may also be on the shorter side because, again, I'm producing the show on the road, which makes things slightly more difficult. But have no fear, I'm up for the challenge. Well, at least for this week. I may have to skip next week and take that time off to be with family and also travel back home safely, so I apologize for that, but I promise to pick things back up once I'm back home. But who knows, maybe I'll surprise all of us and actually produce another show on the road. We'll see. Today I found a pretty interesting case that I've never heard of before, and I'm assuming neither have you. So I hope you guys are excited to hear a new crime story. But before that, let's jump into today's news story topic. The Chula Vista Police Department served another search warrant at the home of Maya, or also known as May, Millette. May is a mother who tragically has gone missing for 4 months now. Police have never named her husband as a suspect and say he's no longer cooperating with their investigation. This is the second time the police have searched the home, according to the CVPD. Officers were seen carrying boxes out of the home while others led canines around the property. What appeared to be rifles and boxes typically used to store ammunition were loaded into a police van. CVPD arrived at the home at 4:30 p.m. and were there on property until after 11 p.m. Meanwhile, 60 to 70 supporters of May's family surrounded the property as the police worked. Searches for her have been conducted by the family, loved ones, and even strangers who just want her to come home. The efforts have even expanded across county lines in the hopes that something will turn up to provide a clue to her whereabouts. May's family have created a website with information on how to support their efforts and any future searches, as well as blog updates from her loved ones. It will, of course, be linked in the show notes below. The criminal investigation into Millette's disappearance is ongoing. Police are urging anyone with information on her whereabouts to contact detectives at 619-691-5139. It was August 15, 1964, in the quiet little community of Chula Vista, California. Around midnight, a car pulls up and parked next to Rosebank Elementary School. A lean 18-year-old boy got out of the car and stretched his arms and legs. He ran his hand through his straight blonde hair and rubbed the strain of the night dry from his eyes. The teen walked across the street to the quiet one-story house with the well-kept yard. He entered the garage and picked up an 18-inch iron bar, wrapped a towel around it, and walked into the house. He took off his shoes and socks in the kitchen and silently walked down the hallway. The intruder found his way to the master bedroom. He turned the handle and crept into the dark room. Inside, a couple lay sleeping in bed, unaware that a nightmare had slipped in. The intruder raised the iron bar over his head and brought it down forcefully, crushing the skull of his sleeping victim. Blood and brain matter gushed from the wound. The boy gave his male victim several more punishing blows before he turned to the screaming woman in the bed next to him. He pummeled the woman with the same weapon, slamming her head so hard it spattered blood and brain tissue against the wall and even the ceiling. The bedroom was turned into a scene from a horror movie. The boy's attention went back to the man who was struggling to sit up in bed. The intruder swung the iron rod again and bashed the man across the face and head. He then hit the man's wife one more time as well, making sure she was dead. Once the job was done, he crept down the hall to the next bedroom. Inside were the victim's 15-year-old daughter still fast asleep. Once again, he lifted the iron bar and dealt deadly blows to the teen girl, showing her the same fate as her parents. her face and skull crushed with each impact. The killer walked back to the hall to his final victim's room. Inside, an 8-year-old boy tossed in his sleep. Again, the iron rod was hammered into the victim's head, bashing the small, fragile skull with ease. Once the intruder was satisfied with his work, he returned back to the master bedroom and lit a cigarette. He watched with deranged enjoyment as the man of the household struggled to crawl out of the bed. Spotting a hunting knife on the dresser table, the killer traded in his iron bar for the blade. He gazed at the knife with a glee, saying, "Maybe this will finish him off." He repeatedly thrust the knife into the man's back over and over and over again, sealing his fate. The killer washed himself from the crime in the bathroom, leaving behind print marks and blood from the slaughter. In the mirror, he told himself, "You better get out of here," and slipped out of the house and back to his car. On the morning of August 15th, 1964, Raymond Giadec ate breakfast at the Lutheran Mountain Church camp at Valley Center. He had been away at the camp, but was packing up his car to head back home to Chula Vista. At 6:15 a.m., Raymond drove himself and two camp friends back into town. After driving 50 miles, Raymond dropped one of the friends off and took the second friend, Christine Lansing, over to his house, arriving at 7:30 a.m. The two entered the Giadec home and were surprised to see that the rest of Raymond's family was still in bed. Raymond lived with his parents and was the oldest of three kids. They were often early risers and were typically enjoying breakfast around this time. Raymond yelled, "Get up, you lazy bones," and went down the hallway to wake up his household. Christine waited in the kitchen and looked about the room. The house was pretty messy from what she could tell. The Giadecs usually kept a tidy home, so this stood out to Christine. However, her observation was interrupted by Raymond making a loud noise in the back room. She raced over to him to see what was wrong and stumbled upon the gruesome crime scene in the master bedroom. Christine called the police and an investigation into the Giadecs' murder began. After looking about the house, a policeman drove the pair to the station to obtain a statement from them as material witnesses. Christine and Raymond told their stories about coming back from camp and stumbling upon the scene. Police believed the home to have been broken in by robbers. The criminal appeared to have snuck into the home through the garage. Chula Vista was a quiet and quaint area at this time, and people often left their doors unlocked, therefore, easy access for anyone with bad intentions. The criminal then murdered the family, and then proceeded to toss the house in search of valuables. Drawers were left open, and things had been thrown about the house. While listening to Raymond's account, one detective noticed what appeared to be flecks of blood in his blonde hair and on his ear. They had him remove his clothing and found numerous stains on them as well. Most of the stains proved to be that of human blood. Raymond also had an injury to his right hand. When asked how it happened, he told them that he had cut it on his car door. Later, they examined the two shirts they found in Raymond's car, and they both had faint bloodstains on them as well. So at this point, Raymond was looking very suspicious to police and became suspect number one. Investigators looked into this angle and questioned others who attended the church camp. Several people gave testimony that confirmed Raymond had left the camp the night of August 14th, 1964, therefore ruining his alibi of being at camp. An attendant for a service station at Chula Vista testified that Raymond had stopped at the station to use the restroom sometime between 2 and 4 a.m. on August 15th, 1964. He also confirmed that Raymond had been driving in the direction towards the camp. Upon investigation, a towel was found in that said restroom, and it was stained with human blood. Detectives then took a closer look at the evidence documented from the crime scene. In the bathroom where the killer had appeared to wash up, he left behind a few bloody fingerprints. On August 16th, 1964, the police made lifts of those fingerprints, and sure enough, they matched Raymond's. So now police had testimonies erasing his alibi and showing that he could have been present during the time of the murder, as well as his bloody fingerprints tying him to the actual crime. Raymond was then arrested for the murder of his mother Joan, father Henry, 15-year-old sister Ellen, and 8-year-old brother Mark. Chula Vista was built out of land that was once lemon groves, and it had been the lemon-growing center of the world at one time. Nothing of great importance ever seemed to happen there. It was the sort of place you could ride your bike down the street and leave your door unlocked, a safe place to raise children. So when this murder story broke the news, the entire community was shocked and horrified. A woman who grew up near the geodex said, quote, "The story overwhelmed those of us who had grown up in the sleepy little town. It was one of our own that had murdered the whole family. But why? Why indeed?" Now, Raymond was always known to be a shy but polite teenager in town. He was in the school choir and was active in his church. He went on to enter Lutheran Concordia College after high school. He hoped and planned to enter Southwestern College in Chula Vista that fall. His grades were never anything remarkable, though. For Raymond, life was school and working for his father. Henry Geodek and the family were members of the Pilgrim Lutheran Church, where he served as an elder, and his trade was as a landscape architect. In interrogation, Raymond told the police more than once how he felt about his father. Police Lieutenant Roy Brocher, who was a friend of the family, testified that young Geodek told him he hated his father because he kept demanding better work at school. Tensions between father and son seemed to be high. The trial began, and the police and prosecution thought that this was as close to an open and shut case that they could ever hope for. Raymond took the stand in his own behalf and admitted to killing his parents, brother, and sister, but said that he did not know why he killed them. He then gave the following version of events from the night in question. After attending a religious program at the camp church, he slept in his car. He awoke during the night and went for a drive. After driving a while, he decided to go home for some coffee. He parked across the street from his house, and as he passed through his garage, he kicked an iron bar and picked it up. He wrapped a towel around the bar and removed his shoes and socks in the kitchen, a habit he acquired when new carpeting was laid in his home. He then went into his parents' room, where he beat his father and killed his mother. He then proceeded to murder his younger siblings. To finish off his father, he plunged a knife in him so many times that the coroner who did the autopsy gave up counting and simply wrote multiple stab wounds on his report. Raymond then literally tried to wash his hands clean of his crime in the bathroom sink. But he was a bit sloppy and left behind bloodied fingerprints near the sink and on some of the molding. To further cover his tracks, he ransacked the house to make it look like a violent break-in. As he left the home, his thought was, "Raymond, get out of here," but other than that, he didn't know what was in his mind during this episode. Sometime in the overnight hours of August 14th and 15th of 1964, Raymond then traveled 50 miles back to the camp, but made a pit stop to dispose of evidence. Apparently, Raymond had washed out two shirts in the station sink and left behind that bloody towel later found by police. Once back at camp, he acted as if nothing had happened and ended up driving Christine home, where the two of them, quote-unquote, discovered the murders together. Now, this version of the story made much more sense. A neighbor of the geodex said that she knew whoever broke into the home and committed those murders had to be someone who frequented the house, because her dog never barked that entire night. Her dog would have barked at a stranger, but not Raymond. So it only made sense. Plus, there were no signs of a forced entry. As for a motive, Geodek, who worked for his father in the family store, had recently argued with his father about moving out of the family home. The next-door neighbor with the dog also said she had heard Henry yelling at Raymond about something he had done while working in the yard one afternoon, and saw Henry strike Raymond. Apparently, there was a long history of dominance and abuse in the household. Several witnesses backed up the neighbor's claim and reported hearing conflicts between the father and son. Evidence was introduced in the trial that a few days before the killing, the defendant and his father had an argument about Raymond moving out. Raymond told his father, quote, "You've taken advantage of me for 6.5 years and I can't take it anymore." Their relationship was strained, as I mentioned before, and Raymond was struggling with not having hatred grow between himself and his father. He was going to leave home, but he still intended to work with his father. Lieutenant Roy Brochers said that the youth assuredly told officers he planned to kill his father, so his brother and sisters would not have to grow up in the same environment he had to live under. Brochers continues, quote, "This resentment had been building for a period of several years. He felt his father had been unfair and demanding toward himself, his mother and sister and brother. It just bugged him and he couldn't cope with it anymore." So I think it's pretty clear by now who, how, and why the crime was committed. And the jury agreed. Raymond Henry Giadec was indicted for the murder of his father, mother, brother, and sister. The jury found him guilty of first-degree murder for his father and second-degree murder of the rest of the family. Now, what's interesting about this trial is that it played out in two phases. In his defense, Raymond had put forward the defense of not guilty because he was insane at the time he committed the murder. At that time, California law required the courts to put the question of a defendant's sanity to the jury separate from the question of guilt. In other words, during the guilt phase of the trial, the jury concluded Raymond was guilty based upon the evidence. But now during the sanity phase, the jury would be asked to decide whether Raymond, having been convicted of the crime, was sane or insane when he performed the act. This was a literal life or death question for Raymond, because if he was found completely guilty, he would be headed off for the gas chamber in San Quentin and put to death. But if he was found insane, he would be headed for a mental institution. Psychiatric testimony concerning the defendant's mental condition on the night of the killing was introduced by both parties. The defense had testimonies by psychiatrists that Raymond was legally insane when he committed the murders. An example of this is that when the police first arrived at the crime scene, Raymond had greeted them with a casual, "Hi." That was obviously not the type of greeting they were expecting from someone who just found out his entire family was brutally murdered. The defense psychiatrists explained that his nonchalance was really a form of insanity. But the prosecution psychiatrists testified to the contrary. So, at the end of the trial, there really wasn't a clear-cut determination of which psychiatrists were to be believed. The jury came to the conclusion that Raymond was sane when he attacked his father for the first time, then insane as he killed his mother and siblings, then returning to sanity, murdered his father. So, there you have it. Raymond managed to escape the gas chamber. Raymond Giadec was convicted of first-degree murder on December 8, 1964. However, the verdict was subsequently reduced to second-degree murder. Finding that his state of mind, while sane in regards to the father's death, was still insufficient to uphold a verdict of first-degree murder, the Supreme Court ordered the trial court to reduce the conviction to second-degree murder and sentence Giadec accordingly, thus acquiring that second-degree murder charge. What do you guys think about this case? Do you agree with the outcome? And where do you guys stand when it comes to his sanity? Me personally, I think that he was not sane when he killed his father. I mean, he clearly had a motive to kill him with the whole power struggle, as well as him wanting to move away. But I just don't understand how he could go on to kill his younger siblings. The mom, sure, because, you know, she was in the room with the father and could have been killed in his blind rage or in fear or panic of being stopped or turned in. You know, she may have just been caught in the crosshairs. But he could have stopped there and left the home. But no, he continues on down the hallway and gives his siblings the same brutal treatment, which to me seems deliberate and leads me to think that he was sane. Otherwise, I would have expected him to snap out of it and realize, you know, what he's done. But Then again, I'm not a psychiatrist, so it's really hard to tell when sanity begins and ends. I'd also be curious to know if Raymond perhaps also struggled with some kind of mental illness, which may have attributed to his murders. He obviously wasn't diagnosed with anything, but then again, it was the early 60s, and we all know how little knowledge they had about mental illness back then. So perhaps that could be a contributing factor. Either way, it's a very sad story, and I will never understand how anyone could eradicate their own family. So although this was a sad one, I do like covering these older and possibly forgotten, or at least non-mainstream cases, because it keeps the memory of the victims alive, and it gets more people aware of these older cases like this that had such a shaking impact on a community. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. If so, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes. The link is down below in the show notes for your convenience. I'll also be posting some pictures and videos, and maybe some behind-the-scenes content on the show's Instagram, which is also linked below. So if you're interested in seeing some of that, feel free to follow me there if you haven't already. I do check Instagram the most, so if you also have case suggestions for future episodes, feel free to comment them or DM me there. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day, and until next time, my friends, stay safe.